This is the first tape of a conversation with Minister Malcolm X, June 2nd. From what I have read, which includes books I could find and a good many articles on the black Muslim religion and on yourself, it seems that the identity of the Negro is the key fact that you deal with. Is that true? Is that impression correct?
Yes, yes. And not so much in the sense of the black Muslim religion.
Yes.
Both of them have to be separated.
Yes.
The black people in this country are taught that their religion and the best religion is the religion of Islam. And when one accepts the religion of Islam, he's known as a Muslim. He becomes a Muslim. That means he believes that there's no God but Allah and that Muhammad is the apostle of Allah. Now, besides teaching him that Islam is the best religion, since the main problem that Afro-Americans have is a lack of cultural identity, it is necessary to teach him that he had some type of identity, culture, civilization before he was brought here. But now, teaching him about his historic or cultural past is not his religion. This is not, it's not
yes.
religious. The two have to be separated.
Yes. What about the matter of personal identity and related to cultural and blood identity?
I don't quite understand.
I'm trying to get at this. As a man may know that he belongs to, say, a group, this group or that group, but he feels himself lost within that group, trapped within his own deficiencies and without personal purpose. Lacking personal identity, you see.
Yes. Well, the religion of Islam actually restores one's human feelings. Human rights, human incentives, human his talent. The religion of Islam brings out of the individual all of his dormant potential. It gives him the incentive to develop his dormant potential so that when he becomes a part of the Brotherhood of Islam and is identified collectively in the Brotherhood of Islam with the brothers in Islam, at the same time, this also gives him the it has the psychological effect of giving him the incentive as an individual to develop all of his dormant potential to its fullest extent.
A personal regeneration, then,
yes.
Is associated automatically
oh, yes.
with this.
Yes.
Sometimes in talking with Negroes in other organizations and other persuasions, I've found that there's a deep suspicion of any approach which involves the old phrase self-improvement, you see.
Yes.
And to state the matter on objective, impersonal matters such as civil rights, integration, job programs, and not on the question of self-improvement or, you might say, the individual responsibility.
You
take a different line.
Definitely. Most of the... or I should say many of the Negro leaders actually suffer themselves from an inferiority complex, even though they say they don't. And because of this, they have subconscious defensive mechanisms which they've erected without even realizing it. So that when you mention something about self-improvement, the implication is that the Negro is something distinct or different, and therefore needs to learn how to improve himself. Negro leaders resent this being said, not because they don't know that it's true, but they're thinking, they're looking at it personally. They think that the implication is directed even at them, and they duck this responsibility. Whereas the only real solution to the race problem in this country is a solution that involves individual self-improvement and collective self-improvement, and whereas our own... wherein our own people are concerned.
Could you tell me, or would you be willing to, or do you think it's relevant, some detail of your own conversion to Islam?
Well, I was in prison.
I know that fact, yes.
And in the
interior feeling of the, yes. of the process.
Yes, well, I was in prison, and I was an atheist. I didn't believe in anything. And I had begun to read books and things, In fact, one of the persons who started me thinking seriously was an atheist. Another Negro inmate whom I heard in a discussion with white inmates and who was able to hold his own at all levels. And he impressed me with his knowledge, and I began to listen very carefully to some of the things he said. And it was he who switched my reading habits in a direction away from fiction to nonfiction, so that by the time one of my brothers told me about Islam, although I was an atheist, I was open-minded, and I began to read in that direction, in the direction of Islam, and everything that I read about it appealed to me. And one of the main things that I read about it that appealed to me was, in Islam, a man is regarded as a human being. He's not measured by the color of his skin. At this point, I hadn't yet gotten deep into the historic condition that Negroes in this country are confronted with. But at that point, in my prison studies, I studied Islam as a religion, more so than, as I later come to know it, in its connection with the plight or problem of Negroes in this country.
This is getting ahead a little bit, but it seems to apply here. Islam teaches a human worth of all men without reference to color. How does that fact relate to the message of black superiority and the doom of the white race?
Well, the white race is doomed not because it's white, but because of its deeds. And the people listen very closely to what the Muslims have always declared. They'll find that in every declaration there is the fact that the same as Moses told Pharaoh, you're doomed if you don't do so-and-so. Or as Daniel told, I think it was Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar, you are doomed if you don't do so-and-so. Now, always that if was there, which meant that the one who was doomed could avoid the doom if he would change his way of behaving. Well, it's the same here in America. When the Muslims deliver the indictment of the American system, it is not the white man per se that is being doomed.
It's not blood itself that's being, there's no blood damnation then.
No, but see, it's almost impossible to separate the actions. Or it's almost impossible to separate the oppression and exploitation, oppression and criminal exploitation of the American Negro from the color of the skin of the person who is the oppressor or the exploiter. So he thinks he's being condemned because of his color, but actually he's being condemned because of his deeds, his conscious behavior.
Let's take a question like this. Can a person, an American of white blood, be guiltless?
Guiltless?
Yes.
Well, you can only answer it this way, by turning it around. Can the Negro, who is the victim of the system, escape the collective stigma that is placed upon all Negroes in this country? And the answer is no. Because Ralph Bunche, who is an internationally recognized and respected diplomat, can't stay in a hotel in Georgia, which means that no matter what the accomplishment, the intellectual, the academic, or professional level of a Negro is, collectively he stands condemned. Well, the white race in America is the same way. As individuals, it is impossible for them to escape the collective crime committed against the Negroes in this country collectively.
Let's take an extreme case like this, just a most extreme example I can think of. Let us say a white child of 3 or 4 or something like that who is outside of conscious decisions or evaluations is facing accidental death, you see. Is the reaction to that child the same as the reaction to a Negro child facing the same situation?
Well, just take the Negro child. Take the white child. The white child, although it has not committed any of its as a person, has not committed any of the deeds that has produced the plight that the Negro finds himself in, Is he guiltless? The only way you can determine that is take the Negro child who's only 4 years old. Can he escape? Though he's only 4 years old, can he escape the stigma of discrimination and segregation? He's only 4 years old.
Let's put him in front of the oncoming truck and put a white man on the pavement who must risk his life to leap for the child. Let's reverse it.
I don't see where
some
that...
Some white man would leave, some wouldn't.
It still wouldn't alter the fact that after that white man saved that little black child, he couldn't take that little black child in many restaurants, hotels, and places right along with him. Even after the life of the black child was saved, that same white man would have to toss him right back into discrimination, segregation, and these other things.
Well, suppose, let's take a case, suppose that white man is prepared to go to jail to break segregation.
His going to jail to break segregation still hasn't, and if he broke segregation.
Let's keep it on the individual, just one white man.
You can't solve it individually.
But what you added toward the one white man who goes to jail, say not once, but over and over again.
This has been going on for the past 10 years.
Yes.
White individuals have been going to jail. Segregation still exists. Discrimination still
exists.
Yes,
that's true. But what is the attitude toward the white man who does this, who goes to jail?
My personal attitude is that he has done nothing to solve the problem.
What's your attitude toward his moral nature?
Not even interested in his moral nature. Until the problem is solved, we're not interested in anybody's moral nature. What I'm boiling down to say is that a few isolated white people whose individual acts are designed to eliminate this, that, or the next thing, but yet it is never eliminated, is in no way impressive to me.
That is, you couldn't call that man a friend.
If his own rights were being trampled upon, as the rights of Negroes are being trampled upon, he would use a different course of action to protect his rights.
What course of action?
I have never seen white people who would approach a solution to their own problems nonviolently or passively. It's only when they are so-called fighting for the rights of Negroes that they nonviolently, passively, and lovingly, approach the situation. But when the whites themselves are attacked, they believe in defending themselves and things of that sort. But those type of whites who are always going to jail with Negroes are the ones who tell Negroes to be loving and be kind and be patient and be nonviolent and turn the other cheek.
But
so if I did see a white man who was willing to go to jail or throw himself in front of a car, in behalf of the so-called Negro cause, the test that I'd put to him, I'd ask him, do you think when Negroes are being attacked, they should defend themselves, even at the risk of having to kill the one who's attacking them? If that white man told me yes, I'd shake his hand. I trust in him. But I don't trust any white man who teaches Negroes to turn the other cheek or to be nonviolent, which means to be defenseless in the face of a very brutal criminal enemy. No. That's my yardstick for measuring whites.
Now the question, what is defenseless at this point?
Anytime you tell a man to turn the other cheek or to be nonviolent in the face of a violent enemy, you're making that man defenseless. You're robbing him of his God-given right to defend himself.
Let's take a concrete case again on the question of defenselessness, just to be sure I understand you. If, say, in the case of Dr. Aaron Henry in Mississippi, Clarkson, Mississippi, his house has been bombed and been shot through and that sort of thing. Well, he is armed. I've been in his house. I know he's armed. He's guards sitting there with arms in their hands at night. And everybody knows this. Now, I can't see how anyone would ask him not to defend himself. You see? If defense is literally defense, as it's taken in ordinary legal times, or a mounted aggression for purposes of defense is another thing in a society. See what I'm getting at? A man sitting in his own house...
I think that a Negro...
A blow is one thing. A man who goes out and performs an act of violence it's some sort of idea of long-range defense.
I think that a Negro should reserve the right to execute any measure necessary to defend himself. Any way, any form. necessary to defend himself, he should reserve the right to do that just the same as others have the right to do it.
Political assassination, for instance?
I don't know anything about that. I wouldn't even answer a question like that. But I say that the Negro, when they cease to look at him as a Negro and realize that he's a human being, then they will realize that he is just as capable and has the right to do anything that any other human being on this earth has the right to do to defend himself.
Well, there are millions of white people who would say right away that the Negro should have, any Negro should have the same legal rights and defense that a white man has.
And I think you'll find also that if the Negro ever realizes that he should begin to fight for real for his freedom, there are many whites who will fight on his side with him. It's not a case where people think he'll be the underdog or be outnumbered, but there are many white people in this country who realize that the system itself, as it is constructed, is not so constructed that it can produce freedom and equality for the Negro. And the system has to be changed. It is the system itself that is incapable of producing freedom for the 22 million Afro-Americans. Just like a chicken can't lay a duck egg. A chicken can't lay a duck egg because it's the system of the chicken isn't constructed in a way to produce a duck egg. And just as that chicken system can't produce, is not capable of producing a duck egg, the political and economic system of this country is absolutely incapable of producing freedom and justice and equality and human dignity for the 22 million Afro-Americans.
You don't see in the American system the possibility of self-regeneration then?
No, nothing. There's nothing
of change.
No, the American system itself is incapable. It is as incapable of producing freedom for the Afro-American as the system of a chicken is of producing a duck egg.
You don't see any possibility of gains or better solutions through political,
no.
Negro political action or economic action?
Well, anytime the Negro becomes involved in mature political action, then the resistance of the politicians who benefit from the exploitive political system as it now stands will be forced to put exercise more violent action to deprive the Negro of his mature political action.
Do you think that Adam Clayton Powell's political career has been one of mature political action? He thinks highly of you and speaks to me highly of you.
Adam Clayton Powell, Adam Clayton Powell's entire political career has to be looked at in the entire context of the American history and the history of position of the Afro-American or Negro in American history. And then when you take all of these factors combined, you can see where Adam Clayton Powell is a remarkable man and has done a remarkable job in fighting for rights of black people in this country. On the other hand, he probably hasn't done as much as he could or as much as he should, because he is the most independent Negro politician in this country. There's no politician in this country of national stature who is more independent of the political machine as Adam Clayton Powell is.
Well, Dawson was a pure victim of it, of course. Chicago. Congressman Dawson.
Yes, I don't know too much about Dawson, but from what I've heard, he has no independence of action when it comes to the political machine.
That's
there
not
in Chicago.
But is Adam Clayton Powell's line a line of what you'd call mature political action? Or has that been frustrated in...
In my opinion, mature political action is the type of action that involves a program of re-education and information that will enable the black people in the black community to see the fruits that they should be receiving from the politicians who are over them, and thereby they are then able to determine whether or not the politician is really fulfilling his function And if he is not fulfilling his function, they then can set up the machinery to remove him from that position by whatever means necessary. To me, political action involves making the politician who represents us know that he either produces or he is out, and he's out one way or another.
There's only one way to put a politician out ordinarily, is to vote him out.
Well, I think that the black people in this country have reached the point where they should reserve the right to do whatever is necessary to see that they exercise complete control over the politicians in the politics of their own community by whatever means necessary.
Let's go back to the matter of your conversion. Some details of that. Was it fast or slow? A simple matter as that.
It was fast.
Flash of intuition.
No, it was fast. Strange as it may seem, I took an about turn overnight.
Really overnight, just that.
Yes. And while I was in prison and wasn't a Muslim, I was indulging in all types of vice right within the prison. And I never was ostracized as much by the penal authorities while I was participating in all of the evils of the prison as they tried to ostracize me after I became a Muslim.
Why was that?
Well, the prison systems in this country actually are exploited, and they're not in any way rehabilitated. They're not designed to rehabilitate the inmate. Though the public propaganda is that this is their function, but most people who work in prison earn money through contraband. They earn extra money by selling contraband, dope, and things of that sort to the inmates, and so that really is an exploitive.
This is a matter of defending their commercial interests, economic interests, and not a matter of fear of the Muslim movement. Is that it?
Both. They have a fear of the Muslim movement and the Muslim religion because it has a tendency to make the people who accept it stick together. And I had one warden tell me since I've been out, and I visited an inmate in prison right here in New York, Warden Fahey, up at Greenhaven.
Fahey.
F-A-Y. In 1959 or 8, along in there, I visited an inmate in prison, and he told me that he didn't want anybody in there trying to spread this religion. And I asked him at that time if it didn't make a better inmate out of the Negroes who accepted it, and he said yes. So I asked him then what was it about it that he considered to be so dangerous. And he pointed out that it was the cohesiveness that it produced among the inmates. They stuck together. What you did to one, you did to all. So they couldn't have that type of religion being taught in the prison.
It's just a matter of maintaining their own control then.
Yes.
Has there been any change in your religious beliefs since your break last fall?
Well, I have gone through the process of re-evaluating, giving a personal re-evaluation to everything that I ever believed and that I did believe while I was a member and a minister in the black, in what we call the Black Muslim Movement.
May I ask how you come out of that evaluation?
Well, first I might say that when a man separates from his wife, at the outset, it's a physical separation, but it's not a psychological separation. He still thinks of her in probably warm terms. But after the physical separation has existed for a period of time, it becomes a psychological separation as well as physical. He can then look at her more objectively. My split or separation from the Black Muslim Movement at first was only a physical separation. But my heart was still there, and it was impossible for me to look at it objectively. After I made my tour into the Middle East and Africa and visited Mecca and other places, I think that the separation became psychological as well as physical, so that I could look at it more objectively and separate that which was good from that which was bad.
Well, what did you find, if I may ask, good and what bad in this reevaluation?
Well, I think now it's possible for me to approach the whole problem with a broader scope, much broader scope. When you look at something through an organizational eye, whether it's a religious organization, political organization, or a civic organization, if you look at it only through the eye of that organization, you see what the organization wants you to see, which you lose your ability to be objective. But when you aren't affiliated with anything, and then you look at something, you look at it with your eye to the best ability,
well, for example,
see it as it is.
For example, what specific thing do you now see as is and not through organizational eyes?
Well, I look at the problem of the 22 million Afro-Americans as being a problem that's so broad in scope that it's almost impossible for any organization to see it in its entirety. And because the average Negro organization especially can't see the problem in its entirety, they can't even see that the problem is so big that their own organization as such by itself can never come to come up with a solution. The problem is so broad that it's going to take the inner working of all organizations, going to take a united front of all organizations looking at it with more objectivity to come up with a solution that will stand.
Would you work then with the SCLC, Dr. King's organization?
Well, even as a Muslim minister in the Muslim movement, I have always said that I would work with any organization. But I can say it even more with more honesty now. Then when I said it, I would make the reservation that I would work with any organization as long as it didn't make us compromise our religious principles. Now, I think that the problem of the American Negro goes beyond the principles of any organization, whether it's religious, political, or otherwise. The problem of the Negro is so criminal that many individuals and organizations are going to have to sacrifice what they call their organizational principles if someone comes up with a solution that will really solve the problem. If it's a solution they want, they should accept the solution. But if it's a solution they want, as long as it doesn't interfere with their organization, then it means they're more concerned with their organization than they are with getting a solution to the problem.
As I'm trying to see how it would be possible to work with Dr. King's philosophy of non-violence, you see.
Well, see, now, non-violence with Dr. King is only a method. That's not his objective.
No, it's not his objective.
Well, his objective, I think, is to gain respect for Negroes as human beings. And non-violence is his method. Well, my objective is the same as King's. Now, we may disagree on methods, but we don't have to argue all day on methods. Forget the methods or the differences in method. As long as we agree that the thing that the Afro-American wants and needs is recognition and respect as a human being.
This is the end of tape one of a conversation with Minister Malcolm X. Proceed.